Welcome to Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, and I'm Senator Green. And we're here to continue with the hearings on Senate Bill 305. We have some presenters today. British Petroleum, Steve Marshall, and crew are here. And I'll turn the meeting over to you.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, I'm Steve Marshall, President of BP Exploration Alaska. With me today is Angus Walker on my left, BP's Vice President for Commercial. And on my right, no stranger to Juneau, Tom Williams, our Senior Tax Counsel. In a few minutes, Angus will just provide a brief presentation on a number of the issues around the Senate Bill 305. But before that, I'd like to make a few remarks, and I'm thankful for the opportunity to do that. Over the last few weeks, as we've been working through the various committees, both on the House and Senate side, and being in Juneau, meeting with a number of legislators, I've become increasingly concerned about the direction the bills are taking. It seems to me and to us, to BP, that things are heading in the wrong direction. There is clearly a focus on short-term revenues to the state. My worry is that that is being done at the jeopardy of the long-term, longer-term revenues. And to some extent, I suppose we have not done as good a job as we could have in convincing those that we've talked to about the linkage between tax rate, investment, and that investment linkage to production. And the common ground that I think the industry and the citizens of Alaska and the legislature have in common is production. Our singular purpose, if you boil it down to something very simple, is to maximize the recovery of oil and gas from the oil fields in Alaska, and in our case on the North Slope. The natural decline of an oil field or a gas field is inevitable. It's something in the range of 15% for the fields that we have on the North Slope. And through the efforts of our staffs and teams and the investment and the ideas and the innovation, the technology, we are able to arrest that decline to about 6%. For the industry, that represents about $1.5 billion investment per year. Capital investment, wells, flow lines, new facilities, to be able to not only produce oil and gas, but to also handle the water, the solids, the inevitable challenges that come with working in mature fields 20 to 30 years old. In addition to that, we spend, as an industry, in excess of somewhere in the range of $2 billion just to operate those fields. So again, the ongoing maintenance, keeping the wells productive, stimulating the wells to make sure that they're maximizing the production, that represents the investment, about $1.5 billion capital, something in the range of $2 billion just to operate those fields. And what I think is happening right now is that all of those efforts, because there are no big projects, they get lost. The wells that we drill every year, the sidetracks, the new wells, about 100 penetrations is the hard pedaling we do. It's a bit like you look at it, and if you think the industry is like a mill pond, the duck's just sailing along and the oil keeps coming. Actually, we're pedaling very hard underneath the surface, mixing my metaphors there, whatever ducks do. We're actually paddling very hard to offset that decline. And I think the decline is somewhat masked by the high prices that we're experiencing. That's the good news. I mean, I think it benefits us all. I mean, clearly the industry, BP, no exception, we're making very good profits. Very good profits. There is no doubt about that. And resetting the balance there, I think, is something that is clearly the challenge before us, achieving that balance. But the high prices are, I think, offsetting a very worrying trend. The industry's track record, I wish I could say, was exemplary in meeting its forecasts. Not only our own internal forecasts, but also the DNR forecasts. And we've experienced over the last 4 or 5 years, we have missed those in a negative sense every year. Why is that? I think it's from a number of reasons. Drilling wells that have taken longer, projects that have been delayed, maybe for technological reasons, maybe for other external factors, operational upsets, small discrete investments that may take a little longer to mature. Every year as we submit our business plan, it includes many, many discrete individual investments. The $600 million that we're spending this year probably represents maybe 100 different projects, all of which have their own economics and their own relative attractiveness. And it's our job to mature those to the point where we're confident we can actually deliver on what we say we're going to do there. And any time we change one factor, that could be a technological factor or any other factor, it makes the relative competitiveness of those investments less attractive. And clearly, tax is one aspect of that. So I think the delays to projects, all it does is further undermine the production. It accelerates the decline, and that when we lose that momentum, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get back. I think we've shown, as individual companies, as an industry, once we lose the a particular project with, for whatever reason it's delayed, we have nothing there to kind of put in its place. We'll get that production eventually, but it just slides further into the future, and that's the underlying decline here that we're seeing exaggerated. Now, BP's plans over the next 10 years are to spend $14 billion, and that was the plan that we put together in the summer of last year. It clearly represents a significant investment in gas, but that gas only represents about half of that $14 billion. There's another $7 billion tied to oil projects, and that represents almost a doubling of upstream investment, the investment on the North Slope, than what we've experienced in the last few years. We've spent quite a considerable amount in the last few years in what we call our midstream, $1 billion on new tankers, the four new tankers that come in, that are coming into the fleet, the modernization of the pump stations on the pipeline. Are just two examples where we're modernizing our infrastructure. Modernizing the infrastructure for the next 30 years, but at the same time, investing to lower unit costs. And that's one of the big challenges Alaska faces, an incredibly high fixed cost of infrastructure to get oil to market. Unlike many places, the distance to market is a big handicap for Alaska. The actual cost of doing business is high, but it's not extraordinarily high. But the cost to get the product, oil or gas, is considerably higher than just about anywhere else BP operates. And I suspect the same is true for anybody in the industry. But that 2x spend that we're looking at there is what I want to make sure we're not putting in jeopardy. And the 2020 proposal that the governor proposed a few weeks ago, I have to say, was at the outer edge of where BP had been thinking. Prior to that time, we'd been talking about 12.5% as a production tax. So 20% represents a big change. And 2020, 20% tax, 20% credit. In 2006, and with oil prices that we currently have, and with the capital plans that we currently have this year, $600 million, it represents about a 13% production tax. So if you strip it down, the tax and the credit represents about a 13% tax, effective tax on production. Under ELF, under the same circumstances, the same scenario, that's about 5.5%. So it's essentially a doubling of that tax rate. The Senate bill, as it currently stands, represents almost a threefold increase in production tax over ELF. So perhaps that's one way of explaining our concern about less about the revenues for the state, but more about what impact that will have on future investment. That's our mission. That's what the 1,700 direct and 5,000 indirect employees working for BP do every day, is paddle very hard to keep maximizing that production. And certainly our thinking prior to the governor's bill coming out was that an approach which provided the state with considerable upside at high prices, that we accepted and recognized the state's need for that, something we supported. Providing some protection at the downside under low prices, because I think as Angus will show that certainly in the $20 to $25 range, price range, our business makes very little profit, if any. And we'll come to that in more detail, because I know that's been an interesting or an issue that had quite a bit of press recently, and I think it's worth an examination of what's really driving the business there. So we want to just provide as much transparency on that as we possibly can. So our approach was to provide the state with upside at high prices. I think that's something the state has not enjoyed and needs to and should. Some protection at the downside. The middle ground is where we thought the game is to be won or lost. That preserving, to the extent we can, the investment and the investment climate over that mid-range of prices that we've been operating under for the last 2 years is the area where we're most concerned about. So we would argue for something less than 20% in that range. But that would be true progressivity. What it boils down to is increasing the size of the pie, not just increasing the slice of the pie that the state gets. I think where we all win is a bigger pie that we can all share in. I worry that the focus so far has been just on increasing the slice of the pie, and that to me would be a less than optimal outcome for the state of Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to make some remarks, and if there are no questions, I'll turn it over to Angus for the presentation.
Are there any questions at this point? Senator Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your comment about the Senate bill being three times the current rate at 25-20, was that with progressivity included?
Through the chair, no, that is not, does not include the progressivity.
And what would that be with progressivity included?
I don't have those numbers here. They're obviously significantly more, but we can come back to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you. For the record,
Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Further to some conversations we've already had, I would be interested in any comments you have, particularly about the Senate version, that are less attractive in encouraging investment. I'm thinking particularly of the credits and the credits for difficult oil and transition provisions. If there's anything in the Senate bill that could be improved on that side, aside from the ultimate tax rate. And also enjoy your comment on it has been represented to us both in resources and at this table that kind of the rule of thumb is that it takes five times as much credits to equal one percentage on the tax. And I'd enjoy your comments, either or any of you, on is that a good rule of thumb? And does it make the same sense at $60 oil as it does at $25 oil?
Through the chair, I believe that Angus's presentation will address many of those issues. If I could make one, just a couple of framing comments, Senator. I think you're absolutely right in that the tax rate will always out-trump credits. I mean, certainly credits help, but they mitigate the impact of tax rate. And that's why I said the 2020 translates into about 13% for BP this year. So that ultimately is is the factor that goes into the relative attractiveness of a project today versus what it will be like under a new regime. As you increase the incentives, certainly you can make an adjustment on that 13%. But the big driver for that is the tax rate. The follow-on, though, is again, it's an opportunity just to say that tax rate is always out-trumped by production. In terms of its revenue-generating potential, I think Angus's testimony will illustrate that quite graphically, that if we can be successful as a state industry partnership in creating an environment which encourages not only investment that's planned, but can stimulate additional investment, we can grow the pie such that the state theoretically could reduce PPT to zero. I'm not necessarily advocating that, but they could and would still generate more revenue. But I think that will be a key part of Angus's testimony.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Angus Walker, and I'm the Commercial Vice President of BP in Alaska. We have provided detailed written testimony for consideration by the committee, and based on our learnings in previous committees, we weren't going to cover all of that. What we intended to do was make a few remarks and cover some of the key issues and leave the written testimony with you for your consideration. And obviously that should provide more space for questions if you have any. The first thing that's a great start. There we go. The first thing I'd like to talk about is decline. And I draw your attention to the graphic in your pack headed DOR production forecasts. It is an undisputable fact that the North Slope has been in decline since 1988, and the underlying decline rate has been 6% per year. There was a short period of time in the early part of this decade where the decline was arrested as Alpine came on stream and as North Star came on stream. But those fields are peaking and starting to decline, and we see that the basin is returning to the long-run decline rate of about 6% per year going forward. Now, on the right-hand side of this graph, we see the Department of Revenue forecasts. And the fact of the matter is that the Department of Revenue and the industry have systematically revised their forecasts of production down for the last 5 or 6 years. Every year, when it's revisited, we discover that the previous forecast has been too optimistic and the forecast has been revised down. And we see that the latest forecast, which is the little yellow dotted line, the lowest of them, is 3% decline going forward. And that's the spring 06 forecast. And we would advocate that in itself is still optimistic. It will require twice as much investment to be made as has been made in the past. And it is almost certain that forecast will be revised down in the future. And this should worry us. It should worry us all. To put it in context, 100,000 barrels a day of lost production for Alaska equates to $500 million a year in state revenue at current prices. So the fall in production is seriously reducing the revenues that are available to the state of Alaska. So why are we failing to meet these production forecasts? Well, as Steve touched on, they are undoubtedly optimistic. Some things are proving more difficult than the industry thought, and viscous oil would be one example. It's taking longer, it's costing more, but we are making progress. Some things take longer. Some projects have taken longer to execute. North Star would be a great example of that. And there's lots of other smaller projects with it's a difficult environment, and we tend to be optimistic on how long it takes us to do things. And some things just don't work. And for BP, the Badami field is a great example. Hundreds of millions of dollars of investment with very little return whatsoever. But I think the key reason for the production forecast not being delivered is that, in the first place, these forecasts are made up of a number of projects. They're real projects, the real reserves that exist in the North Slope, but they're not based on a realistic capital forecast. There's no constraint in the way these forecasts are put together by the people who put them together to say, does the industry have the capital available to make these projects happen? Does the industry have the capacity to invest it? Is the support structure there for all these projects to happen at the same time? And therefore, we would advocate that they are overly optimistic. They are based solely on the sum of a number of projects, and they're not based in reality. And it's very important as we go forward that this issue is understood. It is the key issue facing the industry. It is the key issue facing Alaska. And we must be realistic about production decline as we progress this debate about what the right level of oil taxation is. If I could direct your attention to the next graphic headed investment offsets decline. Again, on the left-hand side, you'll see the history of decline on the North Slope. And in this case, we've painted three scenarios for future production. The first one, which is the red line headed 15% decline. That shows what would happen if we, the industry, stopped investing on the North Slope. The existing fields would decline, and they would decline at about 15% per year. And the industry would be finished by 2012 or 2013. Of course, the reality is we are investing, and we're investing at a rate of about between $1 and $1.5 billion a year. And that's the next scenario, the green line. And that translates into 6% decline. And that's the long run decline rate of the North Slope. And we would advocate that history will repeat itself. If we spend the same amount of capital, if we do the same things on the North Slope as we have done in the past, we can undoubtedly expect the same result. And therefore, we would forecast, we believe, future decline rate will be about 6% per year. Of course, what we really want is we want a healthy oil business which will be here for decades to come and will be here long enough to enable a gas project, because gas cannot happen if we do not have a healthy oil business. It's just a physical reality of the North Slope that gas cannot happen unless we have a healthy oil business. And in order to make the oil business extend and last to 2050, which is required for gas, we would need a 3% decline rate. In order to achieve a 3% decline rate, we would require that the industry is investing between $2 and $3 billion a year on the North Slope. And that's twice what the industry has been investing. So the real issue here is what does it take to attract twice as much investment to Alaska as has been attracted to Alaska in the past? And clearly, we are seriously concerned that large increases in taxation will not attract the required investment. I'd also draw your attention to the Department of Revenue spring forecast, which lies directly on the 3% decline line. And I said earlier that we believe that forecast will be revised downwards in due course, and it is simply because it requires between $2 and $3 billion of investment to meet that forecast, far more than is being invested today.
Madam Chair. On that point, how much has BP and how much has the industry invested in the last 5 years?
Through the chair.
What's the average?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. We believe the average industry investment is between $1 and $1.5 billion. For BP specifically, BP has spent $2.2 billion in its upstream operations in the last 5 years. And another one.
What's that averaging out for 5 years? It's considered $400 million?
Yeah, BP has been spending about just in excess of $400 million a year in its upstream operations. And I have to say, we've also been investing in our midstream, in the pipelines and the ships. In total, we have spent $3.5 billion over the last 5 years. Well, $2.2 billion has been in the upstream portion of the business, which averages out at just over $400 million a year.
And why were we seeing your increase by another $1 billion in your forecast? Is it because of the high prices of oil, or why the additional change, even when we were not considering changes to the tax structure?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, are you referring to Steve Marshall's
decision? What was the underlying reason for increasing the investment by $1 billion a year, when in for the last 5 years you've been only investing $400 million?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I apologize if I haven't been clear. The investment numbers that we are quoting in this paper and in this graphic, the $1 to $1.5 billion per year, is total industry. That's not BP.
Okay.
And in the 3% decline case, the $2 to $3 billion is total industry.
I'd like to, for the record, Senator Stedman and Senator Wilkin have arrived, and also in the room are Senator Tom Wagner and Senator Gary Stevens, and I think that's the only legislators we have visiting us. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. No, and I'm not sure who to go ahead and direct this to, but now I'm getting a clearer picture that the total industry is investing this amount. And initially, I thought that the investment was up on the North Slope, but it sounds like it's throughout the whole progress of getting the oil to market. So you're involving the pipeline or assets that are off the North Slope, including shipping, is that correct? Or including ships?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the numbers quoted in this slide are total industry and for the North Slope only. It's worth noting that the industry is also making considerable investment in the other parts of the business to make it healthy for the long term.
When you're talking about investing, I thought I heard a reference to ships that were being retooled or brought up to state of the art standards. Is that included in this $1.5 billion?
Indeed, it is not included in these numbers. The numbers here are solely the investments that are required to be made in the upstream portion of the business on the North Slope.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions? Continuing.
It's fair to say that the future will be determined by the industry's ability to invest and by Alaska's ability to attract those investments. I'd like to just take a little bit of pause in our story and talk about what BP is doing to stop decline on the North Slope. And I'm going to share with you our vision, which is a graphic which we have been using for several years as we have formulated our strategy. And very, very simply put, our strategy is to create a 50-year business by focusing on known resources. There are huge known resources on the North Slope. They are very challenging, but they exist. And the challenge is to monetize them. The challenge is to get them to market in an economic way. And they're characterized by the light oil, which has been the business to date, the viscous oil, which we have started to produce, the heavy oil, which is the large resource of cold oil sitting underneath the permafrost, which we haven't started to produce, and obviously gas, which we are focused on getting to market. And what we always say about this vision is that the future is very different than the past. The future will be three businesses, light, heavy, and gas, built on top of each other, all of which are economically interdependent, and all of which must be healthy to deliver the long-term future of the North Slope. And there are many challenges. In each of these parts of the business, there are huge challenges to be met and overcome. But the good news is we are in action. We are pursuing technology in the form of enhanced oil recovery to increase the recovery from existing fields, in the form of ultra extended reach drilling to bring world-class drilling techniques to Alaska to develop the Liberty field from shore, and in the form of identifying the right kind of technology to develop the vast viscous oil resource of the North Slope in an Arctic environment. As I said earlier, we're also investing in the infrastructure to make sure that our ships and our pipeline is fit for the decades to come, and we're developing the organizational capability that it will take to make the future investments that are required. And this year alone, we're in the process of hiring 200 people to add to our organization here in Alaska. And all in all, we have plans to spend $14 billion in the next 10 years. A large part of that is gas, but a large part of it is increasing, in fact, doubling our investment in the oil portion of our business on the North Slope. And we are very concerned that future is being put at risk by the increases in taxes that are being proposed. I'll move back to our three scenarios. To the next colourful graphic, where we have our 15%, 6%, and 3% decline scenarios. And what we've done here is just added a little bit more detail to show the volume of oil that would be produced from the North Slope in each case, the operating expenditures that we as an industry would make to keep the North Slope running for the duration, and the capital investments to be made by the industry. And if I draw your attention to the right-hand column, I'd characterize this by saying that if we are successful in achieving the 3% decline line, then that will require $60 billion of investment, three times as much as we would currently forecast. It would require $100 billion of operating expense, twice as much as we currently forecast. And it would yield 7.5 billion barrels of oil, again, twice as much as we currently forecast. And when we talk to people about this issue, business people outside of the oil and gas business, the thing they say every time is, don't underestimate the economic impact on Alaska of that $160 billion that the industry is going to put into the economy. Don't underestimate the impact on jobs, the ripple effect on the entire economy of Alaska. We then move to look at, well, what's the direct impact of state revenue? And we've assumed just for illustration purposes, we've assumed a $40 ANS price, and we've assumed the 2020 bill as originally proposed, and we've calculated the revenues that would be derived to the state of Alaska. And we see that clearly, when you take into account property taxes, royalty, production tax, state income tax, in every case, the revenue to Alaska is driven by production. And what really matters is getting the most production down that pipeline that we possibly can. And that's what yields greatest revenue to Alaska. It yields the greatest impact on the Alaskan economy. We also see that the PPT, the production tax, is a relatively small part of the big picture. And this is where the genesis of the comment that you could have a zero severance tax if you believed that was the right thing to encourage investment in Alaska. You could have a zero severance tax and you would create greater revenue for the state of Alaska because of all the other taxes that are imposed on the oil and gas industry, the property tax, the royalty, and the state corporate income tax. And of course, the status quo, the 6% decline, has been historically driven by the current tax system, the ELF system. The 2020 proposal is already a significant increase in taxation, and therefore the basic laws of economics would suggest that with the 2020 system, investment is going to be something less than the status quo. Decline is going to be something greater than the status quo. And the outcome will be somewhere, none of us know, somewhere between the 15% and the 6% decline scenarios. And the key question that we believe people should be asking is, what would it take to increase investment? What would it take to double investment in Alaska? Not how much can we raise the tax?
Madam Chair, on that point.
Oh, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier you said that 100,000 barrels of oil reduction meant 500 million less in revenue. At what price of oil was that?
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, that's at the current price of oil, say $60 a barrel.
Okay, and if you take that figure and look at the other direction, and you look at the status quo of current production at 3.6 billion, and at 3% reduction, you have 7.5 billion, about $4 billion more barrels at $60 a barrel. Would the reverse be true that we would receive the $500 million for each increment Therefore, over the life of that investment, the state would get an additional $20 billion?
Through the chair, Representative Hoffman, there's clearly a number of things changing as you go through time. So the first thing I'd say is that the scenario here is at $40, and whereas the number we quoted earlier was at $60. The second thing is that the numbers here are based on an economic model that projects for the next 45 years. And as production declines on the North Slope, then there are still fixed costs, and the cost per barrel increases. Therefore, the profitability in the later end of life is less. So unfortunately, it's not quite as simple as it appears. I think it's probably a detailed question that's better taken offline.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So the question, the next question is, does the tax rate really matter? And I would say absolutely. We'll move to the next slide, which shows the US marginal tax rate. And I should start off by just being clear on the definition of marginal tax rate. The marginal tax rate is the rate that if you're running a business and you have covered all your costs and then you earn an extra $100, the marginal tax rate illustrates what happens to that extra $100. So if the marginal tax rate was 50%, 50% of those dollars, $50, would go to the state. In the yellow, in the center of the graph, are the top 10 producing states in the United States. And we'll see that Alaska is very close to the high, having that already, under the ELF system, having the highest tax rate in the United States at 56%. We then look to the red bars to see what happens under the various proposals that are out there. With the 2020 proposal, the marginal tax rate increases to 61%, and it is, by some margin, the highest tax rate in the United States. With the 2520 proposed in the Senate version of the CS, the marginal tax rate increases to 63%. And then, bolted on top of that, with the progressivity that's been incorporated, it increases at $100 to 67% and then continues to increase thereafter with no cap.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stedman?
On that point, if there wasn't progressivity and the price was $100, Madam Chair, I was wondering what that number would be.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, without progressivity, the marginal tax rate would remain in the Senate version of the bill at 63%, and in the House version of the bill, at 2020 it would be 61%, at 2520 it would remain at 63%. So it would not increase.
Donald?
Correct. We'll have more questions later when we move and start putting the rest of these pieces together.
Okay. These are obviously very high tax rates indeed. And in our mind, unthinkable that they will yield additional investment over the existing system. I would draw your attention to the left-hand side of the page. If you want to see somewhere where business is booming, go to Alberta, go to the Gulf of Mexico. These are the places that are attracting billions and billions of dollars of investment. And they're doing so by being open for business. and by creating fiscal systems which are designed to attract investment. Alberta, specifically in their heavy oil province, has adopted a 1% royalty in order to encourage investment until the payback of a specific project. And they are getting billions of dollars investment year on year.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I'm wondering, a thing that complicates our decision making is the need for fiscal certainty. I think some Alaskans, if they're making a decision that's going to remain unchanged for 20 or 30 years, it causes them to have a great deal of caution. In the Alberta and the Gulf of Mexico, is there fiscal certainty? Is this tax rate subject to change, and at what? In what time frames would it be subject to change?
Through the chair, I don't know the exact terms on the Alberta royalty, but I do believe there are some assurances that go with that. So we'd have to respond to that separately. I think the other piece is that Alaska is in a very unique position by considering the investment in a $20 to $25 billion gas pipeline. And it is that unprecedented investment which is driving the need for long-term fiscal certainty.
Thank you.
Senator Stitt.
I think it's pretty interesting when we look at, Madam Chairman, when we look at the less than 40 and then at the $100, the huge marginal tax rate. But I think we need to keep in mind that we use taxes, royalties, and property tax as a method of selling our resource versus a sale price of a loaf of bread at a store. So it's a little different mechanism, but the numbers are fairly close to the numbers run by the Department of Revenue, but they also show at $40 a barrel under the 25-20 in front of us, the corporate profit margin would be 35.5%. So there is still some margins left in it. Under the current scenario at $40 a barrel, and again, this is aggregate, not company specific. The aggregate numbers, the corporate profit margin, again, under the current ELF system at $40 is 37.9%. So what we're talking about is at $40 a barrel, marginal difference between 37.9 on a corporate profit margin down to 35.5. And I recognize that each company is different, but we can certainly get a copy of these numbers to BP and have them put in their own 2 cents. But these, again, were derived by the Department of Revenue. At $60 a barrel under the current scenario, the corporate profit margins roughly 42.8, and under the 25-20 would go to 32.7. But I'd also like to point out at $20 a barrel, under the current system it's 18.5, and under the proposed it's 23, so it actually goes up. So I think we're going to take a look at some of this stuff as we go forward, as we build this whole top-down view of government take versus industry take, and where is this balance point, and how do we sell our resources through using taxes, if it's a PPT or a severance tax, and royalties, and how do we get a fair value? So it's not like the federal government imposing a federal income tax on corporations or people in general. I mean, it's even though I recognize there's corporate income tax embedded in this, but it's a selling mechanism that we're talking about here. We're selling our resources into a global marketplace and trying to come up with an equitable share between the business entities that extract it and sell it and us that own it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A
couple of years ago, the legislature commissioned the Wood Mackenzie Group to give us an analysis of the investment climate and oil and gas activities in the state of Alaska. And what reminded me of that study was your statement there about one of the most expensive places in the world to produce oil and gas. And if I remember right, and help me if I don't remember, but it said one of the most expensive places in the world to produce and transport oil and gas. And then the rest of the sentence that sometimes gets left off is, but it's also one of the most profitable places in the world to produce and transport oil and gas. So is my recollection of the Wood Mackenzie's conclusions correct, and how does that perhaps flow into your discussion here today?
If I may start with profitability. There's a lot of focus on profitability. Industry has to be profitable to make it invest. Profitability is a good thing. The real issue is are the opportunities presented by Alaska attractive enough to attract industry's capital, not just BP's capital, but industry in totality? And the fact of the matter is that they obviously aren't, because the North Slope is declining at 6% a year, and with the investment that is attracted under the current fiscal system. So therefore, the focus of attention, we believe, should be on what's the right fiscal system to make Alaska attractive, and not on how much can we take from the oil companies. It's not about us. It's about what's right for Alaska. And what's right for Alaska will make the industry work, will make investors come, will make them spend their dollars in Alaska.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could add a comment through the Chair to Senator Wilkin. My recollection of the WoodMac study was that there was comparisons made about the profitability of individual projects. With many studies, you have to look behind that and say, well, what is the impact on individual projects versus the impact on the entire business? And again, one of the things that is unique about Alaska, I think it's fair to say it's unique, is the high fixed cost of the infrastructure to get product to market. It's the huge investment, the $50 billion that's been invested on wells, flow lines, facilities, the pipeline, the new ships that BP and ConocoPhillips have put into service, are putting into service, and will continue to do so. That is unique, I would say, in the business. There's a lot of capital that we employ in this business. And the relative attractiveness, certainly for BP, of this business, certainly at $20, is very, very low. The lowest in our company. And again, the next slide that I think Angus will show will demonstrate that, but it will also show that one of the attractive features about Alaska has been when the prices do go higher, that's when we can make some money. And we haven't apologized for it, and I think that's the debate today and in the future, is where is that balance point? And I think to Senator Stedman's point, I wouldn't disagree that trying to achieve that balance is the goal. The point I would add to that effort is to not only achieve the balance, but to make sure we're maximizing how much product there is to sell for Alaskans and for everybody. It is that balance. So I certainly recognize the need to get a fair price, whatever anyone's definition of fair is, and where is that balance point. But at the same time, let's make sure we don't end up with less product to sell. And if that's the case, if that's the outcome, we all lose. And I think that's the challenge this committee and the legislature faces.
Thank you, Steve.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I think I have a couple of quick questions and a comment. And you may have covered this on slide 9, this one. Is this North American tax rate comparison, is that total government take or just the state's take?
Through the chair, that's total government take, so it includes corporate income tax and it includes private royalties, so it's an apples for apples comparison of the total take in each state.
But it includes the federal?
Indeed.
All right. And I would enjoy seeing on the same graph the size of the expected recoverable oil in each one of those areas, because I suspect that not only what the fiscal regime is, but the size of the prize, it, you know, figures into the business decisions. And then one of the companies that operates as your partner at Prudhoe told me yesterday that our present lifting cost of producing a barrel is, I don't know, $13-$14 range, and that it may go to 15, maybe 16, depending on what we do here in this exercise. Is that a fairly reasonable number?
Through the chair, we have to obviously be careful what we what you include in there and how we describe it. As far as BP is concerned, the break-even point that we have today for our business is $22.50 a barrel. And if I could just break that down a little bit, about $10 to $11 of cash costs. $10 to $11 of cash costs, which is the cost, the operating cost of the field and the pipeline and the transportation. There's then about $6 a barrel of capital cost. That's the capital that was invested to make those barrels come out of the ground. And then there's about $7 a barrel of tax. Because before we actually break even and make a profit, we are paying about $7 a barrel of tax, primarily to the state of Alaska, but with about just less than 50 cents going to the federal government. So that's the reality of our business here in Alaska. And we've been quite open. We've created a little analysis of that that we've shared with everybody around this building, and we're happy to keep sharing it, because that is the reality of our business, that we don't break even until $22.50 a barrel. And that's not the reality that people remember, because the business is changing. The business is getting more difficult. The volumes are declining. The fixed costs remain. The cost per barrel is increasing, and technology is getting more expensive.
Yeah, and just last thing as a comment. Personally, I find it really offensive with the comments that say that what we're after here, in essence, is to be greedy. I want to identify myself with Senator Stedman's comments. So what we're after here is, what's a fair return for the people of Alaska on the loss of their one-time resource? And certainly from my perspective, and most of the folks I know here, it's not about how much can we get. It's not about greed. It's not about how much more can we have to spend on government. It's about what's fair return for the loss of the people of this state's revenue. And I'm sorry that you all see that differently, but that certainly is, you know, my perspective is not about greed. It's not about feeding government. It's about what's fair to the people. And thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could offer a comment, Senator Dyson, through the chair. One of the points you touched on there was the comparison of Alaska under various scenarios to other areas, and what might be the things that would attract investment. Is it simply the tax rate? And I would say, again, as some of the conversations we've had, tax rate is only one factor. And there are many examples that consultants have used which point to higher numbers, lower numbers. I think you can make comparisons on tax rate on many things. I worry that just gives an impression that's the answer, and that's only the first part of the answer. I think what the critical part that has to be looked at is, what is the quantity and quality of oil and gas yet to be found and developed? It's the reason how we can explain why a country like Norway has a very high tax rate, but has experienced 20 years of continuous production growth. And there are many reasons why. One is that the wells, the reservoirs and the wells that are drilled are very, very productive. That you can drain a 100 million barrel reservoir with perhaps 10 wells. You take that same size reservoir in West Texas or Alaska, and it requires many, many more wells to liberate that oil and gas. Higher capital costs, and ultimately lower profitability. So it's the combination of the geology, what it takes to develop fields, and all of the fiscal and economic factors that say, can companies make money? And clearly, despite the 78% tax rate in Norway, companies have come in, invested, and make money. Correspondingly, in Alaska, we've experienced 17, 18 years of decline with a relatively low tax rate. Now, the question facing us is, do we want to continue down that path, or can we achieve a different balance and a different outcome?
Thank you.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. A couple underlying principles important for me, at least, assumptions that we use as we go through this process. Overriding one, of course, is what is in the best long-term interests of Alaska, and hopefully that is a mutually shared and beneficial view. The other is, as we look at the details, here is what is our best guesstimate of the price of oil. Progressivity is part of it, your operating costs and your profit margins, all based on and best guess for price of oil. We've been told by some folks, I think they use 18 of the best oil price prognosticators that in the long term oil is likely to settle back to about $40 a barrel. And I think it's important that we have, knowing that these are only guesses, and at least the state of Alaska's price forecast, the only consistent thing has always been wrong. But it's important that we have an idea as we go through this, what is the best guess we can make in the long-term price of, the long-term price of oil. And does $40 seem reasonable from your side of the table as far as years out?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy. Needless to say, as an organization, we're not in the business of forecasting oil price. We take oil price risk, and we test our projects at a wide range of prices, down to $25 a barrel. I think the prevailing view, if you look across the oil analysts, is that the oil prices will come back to something considerably lower than they are today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. If I may move on to, and I hope in the course of the next slide, I might more adequately deal with Senator Stedman's questions and observations about relative share, and of course what is the right, appropriate, and fair share. And I'm moving, probably skipped a few pages of the written testimony to the one with the six circles on it. And what this is again an analysis of BP's business in Alaska to illustrate the share of the proceeds from the business between BP and government. And we've separated state and federal government. Within the state piece is each of the component of state take. So that includes the property tax, royalty, production tax, and corporate income tax. And if we could start on the top row, which is the status quo. And we'll see that at the $20, that's the status quo assuming the off system. At $20 a barrel, there are insufficient proceeds under the current system for BP to make a profit. So we see that we pay more tax than the proceeds that are available, and therefore we make a loss. And the break-even point is currently $22.50 per barrel. I might just pause, if I may. Senator Steadman referred to some information from the Department of Revenue on profits and shares. If it's the information, I think that we have seen some information, and we're concerned, and I know the Department of Revenue is concerned, that there is information being generated and utilized which is under the heading of corporate profits, which is not actually profit in the way that we all know it. And therefore, we are working through an exercise of the Department of Revenue to actually clean up the information they're using, because we are very worried indeed that there are some very misleading numbers which would suggest that the state and the industry's share is quite different than the way we are see it, based on our financials, which we believe to be accurate. And therefore, we are working through an exercise with them to clean that up.
Madam Chair, if I could, I got good news. The data from Department of Revenue, they've got $20, $40, and $60 barrels, so coincides with their corporate numbers coincide within a percent to the ones you're presenting here. So they're close enough to be on top of each other. Okay. They're out to one digit and you're rounded off, so it looks identical.
Well, that's great. There are some discrepancies and the point at which we break even highlights. I think the Department of Revenue's number has the industry making a reasonable profit at $20 a barrel, and we just don't see that.
Yeah, I should have clarified that. That's at $40 and $60 a barrel. The department's numbers are different from yours at $20, and I recognize there's a difference of interpretation because they're not, in their definition of profit, not taking into account reinvestment of capital to stem the decline. So that's correct.
Okay. But I just flagged that we are going through that exercise to clean that up, because we believe that people need good information to make a good decision.
Excuse me, just a moment. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the chart on the bottom of the page, the status quo means status quo now.
Indeed.
It doesn't indicate what the status quo would be in 5 years or 6 years when ELF pretty well disappears.
Indeed. Just to be entirely transparent, this illustration is based on 2006 data. So for BP, under the status quo, that would assume an effective ELF tax rate of 5.5%.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll return to the top line of circles. And if I move to the $40 a barrel case under the status quo, you'll see that the state's share is still higher than BP's share. And obviously the federal government is getting their slice. And then when we go to $60 under the status quo, BP's share is quite a bit higher than the state's. And that should be no surprise. That's the way the system was designed. It was designed as a regressive tax regime whereby the industry didn't make profits. The state got considerable protection at low prices, but the industry got compensated at higher prices. But we've always said, as we've come into this debate, that we think it's appropriate that some of that high side price is shared with the state. And the 2020 proposal that we agreed to support shares $1 billion from the industry, and an additional $1 billion with the state. If we move to the second row, this is the PPT 2020. I need to be really clear, it doesn't include the progressivity that's been built in. And obviously it's 2020, not 2520. But for illustration purposes, here's what the 2020 does. We still make a loss at $20, we just don't lose quite as much. And the federal government actually start to get a bit more. When we go to $40, we'll see that the BP's share is reduced, the state's share is increased versus the status quo. And then when we go to $60, we will see that the state's share is still higher than BP's share. The point being that it is an increase in tax, therefore it is a transfer of value from BP or the industry to the state. But in every case, the 2020 proposal provides a higher share for the state than for BP. And there's no logic or rule to say that that has to be the case. It's just a fact of the system. But there is information which has been floating around the public arena that suggests that that's not true. And therefore, we just want to put the record straight that under our analysis, the 2020, under all these price scenarios, will give the state a bigger share than BP. Now, we're focused on BP because we know BP's numbers, and we expect they'll extrapolate for industry. So I would move on to there, just to make a few observations about the bill which is before you. And there is, in the written testimony, there's a bit more detail, and we realise that this is probably not the best forum for detailed discussions, and we're very happy to work with the committee or individual members of the committee on specific issues. But maybe I could just make a few comments to frame how we see it. The increase in the base tax rate to 25% is a serious concern and will be a serious barrier to investment in Alaska. The progressivity, which has been added to that, is a further issue. We do not believe that it is appropriate for Alaska, given the challenged nature of the resources, given the urgent need for investment, and given for the regressive tax regime that already exists with royalty. And you end up with a rather perverse regressive, progressive tax regime that in our experience looks like nothing else in the world. Several of the newly introduced terms we advocate are unbalanced and will cause problems. For example, if one was to include progressivity in the ultimate bill, there is no inflation protection. It's not inflated through time. There is no reduction in tax at low prices, which needs to be the quid pro quo in a progressive regime. And it's infinite. The progressivity just keeps increasing. There's never a cap on it. The transition, we recognize that the 2-for-1 transition provision, we can understand the logic for it. It is a barrier to getting the benefits of the transition provision, the transition terms, which we believe are fair. But actually, having thought about it a bit more, we do believe that we can understand why people are, the Senate has gravitated to the 2-for-1 proposal. We think if it was simplified and that investors were assured that they could take benefit of it if they're investing, that there is some merit in it. But we do need to make sure that the benefits are available.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate this going down through some of the major points that are on the table at this committee for discussion that we're going to get to. And I'd like to hear from the industry on the issue of the two-for-one, their viewpoint, which has been alluded to as far as feeling it might be slightly problematic to implement. I think we're all in agreement that to stem the decline of Prudhoe Bay is one of the major goals here, if not the major goal. And I was wondering if a 1.5-to-1 or a 2.5-to-1 or some variation of this wouldn't be more of an enticement for the industry to move from $1 billion to $2 billion a year or whatever they, heading in that direction.
Is that the part that's the problem to implement, though, the rate, or is it the system?
Both. Through the chair, Senator Stidman, I think we are still formulating our views on this. When we first, and we clearly and have always articulated that it's appropriate that there is provision for transition. Clearly, the what came out on the matter of transition, what came out the Senate side, is very much better than what came out the House side, which is where it was struck in its entirety. We can understand the logic for linking the transition, the logic from your perspective, to linking the transition benefits to future investors. And as a company who hopes to invest in this state big time going forward, then we could see that this could be simplified into something that we could support.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Good.
So we'll, either individually or however you want to handle, does BP plan on giving us a more precise recommendation on what they would like to see? We're trying to get feedback in from not only the larger producers, but the mid-sized and smaller ones. So as we try to strike this balance
Indeed, we're very happy to do so, and we will follow up.
Thank you.
The
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in having you flesh out the concerns about the state's reputation with investors. I don't quite understand what you said is if we don't do the governor's bill or at least the five-year portion of the governor's bill in the form that the governor committed to, then that hurts our reputation with investors?
Through the chair, the comment about reputation with investors is really just underlines our belief that it is wholly appropriate that there are transition provisions included in the final bill. There are many ways to get there. So we're not saying that it has to be exactly as those provided in the bill introduced by the governor, but we do passionately believe it's wholly appropriate that there are transition provisions.
Okay, thank you. I understand now.
To add a comment, Madam Chair, just linking Senator Bundy's and Senator Stedman's questions. I think a point I'd like to add is that any number of elements of the bill can be, we will provide, as Angus said, the detailed comments there. But the underlying premise, I think, to us is that when you put all of these factors in, it is the relative attractiveness, the relative economic attractiveness of a specific project today versus what the relative attractiveness of that same project will be under any new scenario. So it's the combination of tax rates, incentives, transition payments, whatever it might be. But when you boil it all down to that effective number on production tax, that is the key differentiator. And the big levers there, again, is to repeat what was said earlier, was the tax rate is by far the biggest driver. Clearly, any number of other things can ameliorate or mitigate or offset some of that, but it is the tax rate that is the real driver. And any time that the relative attractiveness is lower, it is just that much more difficult to attract capital for that investment. We see that today. We'll see it in the future. And it is a big factor in, it's not the only factor, but it is a big factor in capital allocation and decision making and moving forward with projects.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we all understand that the 25, or the tax rate set at 25, is about a 5-to-1 at, currently at $60 a barrel oil impact difference compared to the credit, somewhere in those ballpark ranges. Econ One, who is our economic consultant on this project, is being asked to run some modeling if we moved from a 20% credit to a 25% credit to a 30% credit. I was wondering if we could have BP's initial thoughts on that. But I do understand that the tax is much more sensitive and has a bigger impact. But holding that constant and just moving the credit from their viewpoint, how helpful would that be to expand exploration and drilling on, to stem the decline that we're faced with?
Okay. And you wanted the answer now, or did you want them to?
They can give whatever they want to do.
Immediate reaction, and then
through the chair, Senator Stedman. I think the initial reaction would be that higher credits are good. And it's fair to say that our original proposal to the governor was 12.5% tax rate with 25% credits for a lot of different activities and 15% credits for others. Now, the ultimate governor's proposal was a single credit rate. But the real point being that we were proposing credit rates that were higher than the tax rate. Because we all, I think, are aligned and agreed with the power of the credit system. It would be very good for Alaska to have this credit system to incentivize reinvestment. But on the other hand, so higher credits are good, but on the other hand, you can't increase the credit enough to compensate for large increases in the tax rate, in our opinion. So the real issue here is the tax rate going from 20 to 25%.
I understand that.
Thank you.
Okay. I've touched on the issue of complexity. We believe that this bill has become way too complex for a fiscal regime that is already one of the most complex fiscal regimes in the world. And we would encourage you to think about simplicity as you consider your various amendments to it. And we do not believe that the bill as drafted achieves our mutual goal of increasing investment, stemming decline. And this is where, to Senator Dyson's point, I think we should be entirely aligned with trying to find out what's in the best interest the people of Alaska, and we believe it's in producing as much oil as possible from the North Slope. One point we missed in our haste in preparing for this committee is the start date. I just note that as drafted, this tax came into effect on Friday night. Retroactive application of taxation policy when we are appear to be so far from deciding what is even appropriate or right, we believe is not appropriate and should be avoided. And we would urge you to move the start date at least back to the middle of the year as proposed. And if I may just close by leaving you with a few key messages. It is a fact that Alaska has lots of oil and gas. It is challenging to develop, but production is declining and significant additional investment is required. It is a fact that maximizing production will maximize state revenue and will maximize the benefits to Alaska, to the economy, and to Alaskans. And it is a fact that with the 20% with the 20% tax rate, Alaska will have the highest rate of tax in the United States, and the 25% tax rate is even worse. And it is a fact that the UK and Alberta have successfully attracted significant investment and increased production by reducing taxes, and we would advocate are great role models for this committee. It is a fact that it goes against basic economic theory that increasing taxes will increase investment, and it is our belief that the bill as drafted will not maximize the benefits for Alaskans. We believe there is a better way. We are looking to the committees that are currently considering this bill to help us find it. And we, of course, are very happy to work with you to help in any way we can. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, if we could, and I appreciate your testimony this morning. It was nice, and your printed presentation. I think we've had numerous ones, and this is one of the better ones by far. Could we have a little discussion here, Madam Chair, on the base allowance? Currently, we have in our bill of a 5,000 barrel base allowance, so there's no taxes paid on the first 5,000 barrels, and there's a exponential curve, and it ends at 30,000 barrels for the people watching at home. And initially, we started with a deduction, which in effect was about a $14.6 million tax-free deduction at $40 a barrel per year. And I'm just kind of curious what BP's opinion is on this particular base allowance issue, and is one of the issues we're working on.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'll start from a place where we were in previous testimony, which was that the $73 million we don't believe was ever inserted in the original bill for our benefit, and we would have been, we believe that the focus should be on creating a tax regime that works for everybody rather than providing exclusions. If the tax regime, the rate and the credit work for us, it should work for everybody else. I know that the Senate modified that provision to make it a rate-based provision and excluded the benefit for us. We haven't focused so much on the terms of it because we get no benefit from it, but our original belief would stand that we actually think there should be a level playing field. Everybody should be subject to the same rules, and we should focus on picking the right rate, the right credit, and the right structure that works for everybody.
If I can add a comment, Madam Chair, through the chair, Senator Stedman, the original discussions that we'd had focused on that issue to be basin specific. So that Angus's comments there, I think, are directed at all players on the North Slope. If you look at another area such as the Cook Inlet, where there's fundamentally different geology, different challenges, different costs, different aspects, that could be ring-fenced. You could create a different approach for a particular basin. So that would just be an additional comment to Angus's there.
And if I could, Madam Chair, I got a couple of these. I'm just kind of running down our laundry list. The 95% true-up for the safe harbor section, that's the area of the bill where you got to pay up 95% of the taxes due. Is there any burdensome issues that you see that you'd like to, that you'd like to highlight for us? Or do you think it's just the best part of the bill?
Madam Chairman, for the record, my name is Tom Williams, and I'm Alaska Tax Counsel for BP. And in times past, I worked for the state. As Commissioner of Revenue for Governor Hammond and as Director of Petroleum Revenue prior to that. You've touched on one of the more difficult areas of the bill, an extremely unfair one and an extremely impractical one right now. When you look at an income tax like the federal government's income tax, taxpayers, corporate taxpayers, make quarterly estimated payments to the IRS, and they have a due date of March the following year to be paid up 100%. If they're not paid up with their estimated payments that they made in the quarters of the year when they were doing their business, they don't have a penalty for underpayment if they've paid 90%, which is where this concept of a safe harbor originally arose from. The situation for oil companies in this PPT, in all of the versions, resembles the income tax because you have two sides of an equation that you don't know the answer to as you're going through into the year and as you move through the year. First side is, what is the value of the oil going to be in the remaining months of the year? But you have an obligation to be at 95% on an annual number if you exercise the option under subsection F. Second thing is, you don't know what your costs are going to be, which are your deductions. The deduction side is compounded by the fact that when their costs are capital costs, you're going to have a credit that is a, that that is applicable, and that also will reduce dollar for dollar the liability that you have. So what happens to somebody who starts off and they take the budget that they're looking at for 2006? There they sit on February 28, having to make a payment for January production. This is hypothetical, of course, because it's already happened. It's time past. They make their estimated payment. They can look at what they see as the plan for capital investment this year and budgeted amounts, and they can look at what the operator has actually billed them as the operating costs of a particular field for January. But that's all they know. What happens if during the course of the year there's something unexpected that they didn't anticipate? Maybe there's an event that requires production to be less than what you thought. What if there is a delay in getting something built that you were going to ship up onto the slope and install? What if you have an experiment that you're doing as a pilot project and you anticipate getting results in the first quarter and then acting on that by the fourth quarter, and those expectations don't materialize? You're not going to have the same capital expenditure, the same operating expenditure as you projected for the year going in. Now, if these turn out to be less, these expenditures, less than what you thought they were going to be, that means the deductions are smaller than what you used in making your report for the January production. And if it's a capital expenditure, it means not only the deduction for it, but also the credit for it will be smaller than what you did looking at the beginning of the year. And yet we're being held to a standard, not of 90%, but of 95%. Got to get it right, regardless of what happens here. These originally, in the discussions with the administration, were cast in the form of estimated payments, just like the IRS, except monthly instead of quarterly, because of cash flow considerations. The severance tax currently is a monthly tax. So it would spread that cash flow more uniformly for the state over the year in getting its collections here. But the issues, the challenges of compliance and having right numbers as you're going through the year are exactly the same or very similar in nature as what you have with the federal return. And I would point out again that the federal return for corporations is notionally due, you know, this month, but we get an extension to September, same as folks do. And for filing our state income tax, our extension is 30 days after the federal extension, so be until October. So in the normal situation with a tax where you're looking at these types of expenditures and revenues being offset against each other, we really have a 9 months period, or 8.5 months, after the close of the year in which to double check and get everything sorted out correctly and reported out to partners. And instead, this is going to require that level of accuracy month by month as we're flying blind through the year without knowing how it's going to materialize. So one of the things that on this is it should go back to being an idea of these are estimated payments that are due. There's no problem about saying it's due. But what it should be doing is looking at how the year has elapsed so far. If you're going to have a 90% test, if I'm it at now this month, we would have just paid at the end of March for February production. That should be judged at a 90% standard based on the world as it looked at the end of March. And then be cumulative for the year so that as prices go up or down or as capital expenditures materialize as planned or not, we stay on target to what the whole year is shaping up to look like. It's a cumulative basis rather than for any of the individual months. That would be a workable system that satisfies the state's need to have the cash flows come in as uniformly and regularly as possible and be consistent with our ability, because we cannot use an eight ball to predict what the world is going to look like, and we won't know without some sort of oracle like that to tell us, and yet we'll have this 95% duty of accuracy. It's just not there.
Senator Stedman.
I take that they like the governor's bill more than the White House.
No. through the chair, Senator Stedman, no. The governor's bill suffers from the same problem. Mm-hmm. It's just at a 90% threshold instead of 95%. But it still has a penalty. If you don't predict the future part of the year accurately, you are going to be paying penalty, 5%.
Or she, your manager, says no interest on the penalties on the governor's bill, but we can look at that when we talk with Department of Revenue on this item. And could I have one more, Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
The oil spill surcharge issue, do you have any comments on that? That's in play as far as changing that, increasing it a penny, and making some other changes. Is there? And
maybe we can define.
The proposal in the Resources Committee substitute, as I recall correctly, is to lower the current 2 cent surcharge to 1 cent and to take the 3 cent surcharge and increase it to a nickel. Now the 2 cent surcharge, and now what's proposed to be 1 cent, it goes to sleep. It's the surcharge that replenishes the $50 million with so-called 470 fund, the Oil and Hazardous Substances Spill Response Fund. There's $50 million in that fund, and so that has gone to sleep. It seems to me that reducing that is moving away from where the state would want to be. If you have an incident where that fund is drawn against, I should think you'd rather see it replenished rather than have the period of time where it's below replenishment be extended out. And in this case, by cutting the cents per barrel amount in half, it's going to double the length of time before it can get replenished. Similarly, on a tax that or legislation that's going to add $1 billion or more, depending on what rate you apply and depending on your progressivity decision and depending on your credits, but a major, major tax increase, additional revenues from going to 3 cents to 5 cents on the permanent side can't be the justification for doing that. Not in the context of this legislation.
Okay. That's all, Madam Chair.
That's all. Any other questions? Gentlemen. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If we could go back a second, and I'm not sure who asked this question of it, to this particular graph here with the pies and the state's take versus BP's and the Fed's take on it. I mean, I'd like to go ahead and see, my ultimate question is I'd like to go ahead and see what the 2025 pie would be like in the context that if our goal here at this table or as public policy officials is to provide energy that's available to both business and to the individual out there at a affordable rate at the lowest possible cost, And I realize that, you know, industry benefits from its profits, and the state certainly does from the high price of oil. But I would say that especially people out in my district are going to be adversely affected by the high price of oil. But in looking at the difference between the status quo and even the 2020, it's in industry's benefit to have high price of oil because your take is that much higher of the total percent of the pie. Is that true as it goes to 2020, as 25-20? And you don't have to answer now, but I'm trying to put it in the context of, in the greater picture of providing both business and the individual the ability to go ahead and enjoy a snow machine or to go ahead and provide a commodity to the public at an affordable rate. Do you understand my question?
Maybe I could, through the chair.
Is there much of a difference between the 2025 and the 2020?
There's a significant, the 25% tax rate, 20% credit, mm-hmm. versus a 20% tax rate, 20% credit, is a significant additional burden on industry. And therefore, these will look different. And we're very happy to provide them to you if that helps illustrate the point.
And do you see where I'm trying to go with that? And that is, it'll affect industry significantly. I understand that. But does it ultimately, because what I see here is that at $60 a barrel oil, it's an industry's favor to have high oil prices because the take is so much greater.
Through the chair, with respect, it's in everybody's interest of higher oil prices because everybody benefits.
Well, it's not the interest of the local consumer, though, that are trying to go ahead and make it, for example, agri or other business entities that are out there that are trying to provide a commodity at an affordable rate.
And at high oil prices, clearly the oil companies make more profit. The state gets more revenue, and then we would advocate it's a matter of policy as to what the state chooses to do with the benefits of the higher oil prices.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other questions for these gentlemen? Thank you very much. And I'm kind of taking from Senator Stedman's cue, we may be developing a list of questions that we would like the information back on to kind of help us work through the different pieces that have questions about. And we would like to know if you would be willing to provide information to us to help us get through this.
Yeah, absolutely. As we go forward, we're available to help work with you.
Thank you. I'm kind of undecided how we're going to do that, but we're going to try to figure out a way so we can get the view from all sides. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will extend beyond the regular time today, and if you would like to have a 5-minute break, we can do so, but I mean 5 minutes. Ladies. Senate Finance will come back to order. Welcome.
Thank you.
You may begin.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Owen, and I'm the production manager for ExxonMobil in Alaska and vice president for ExxonMobil Alaska Production. I'm here today to discuss our concerns around the committee substitute to Senate Bill 305. And before I make some specific comments around our concerns, I'd like to take a few minutes just to describe ExxonMobil's history in Alaska, how tax systems impact investments, and our assessment of the remaining potential on Alaska's North Slope.
Thank you. ExxonMobil has had a presence in Alaska for over half a century, investing more than $11 billion in the state's economy. And currently, ExxonMobil has working interests in Prudhoe Bay, Kuparik, Endicott and Granite Point. We're the operator at Point Thompson and we're the largest interest holder in the Prudhoe Bay field. Our current working interest oil production is about 180,000 barrels a day, and we're the largest owner of discovered gas resource. We're proud of the role that our company has played in Alaska through exploration, initial field development, construction of taps, development of new technology, and the promotion of efficient reservoir management practices. Today, our production from Alaska represents approximately 4% of ExxonMobil's worldwide oil and gas production. Our Alaska production is primarily from Prudhoe Bay and nearby satellite fields, and Prudhoe Bay, along with Point Thompson, has significant remaining potential, but it comes at a higher cost and risk. One of ExxonMobil's objectives in both the gas pipeline fiscal contract negotiation and discussion on oil taxes has been to reduce the risk associated with fiscal changes by working with the state of Alaska to establish a predictable and durable fiscal environment in which to make long-term investment decisions. Changes in the fiscal regime for oil directly impact how we view the stability of the Alaska fiscal environment, which in turn impacts how we evaluate ongoing investment decisions. Tax systems need to be carefully designed to ensure that the desired objective of resource development is achieved. And to that end, it's critical to take into account the quality of the remaining resource. Otherwise, a change may result in unintended consequences, such as reduced investment and lower reserve recovery. And when I say the quality of the resource, I mean the size and the nature of the oil and gas reservoirs, the cost of the technology required to develop those reservoirs, the distance to market, as well as the tax and royalty systems that apply, including the long-term stability of that system. Countries experiencing significant industry investment have achieved the proper balance in their fiscal regimes. ExxonMobil's assessment of the remaining oil resource suggests future growth opportunities will come from complex, enhanced oil recovery projects, the development of smaller, more marginal oil accumulations, and innovative development of viscous and heavy oil resources. These opportunities will require the development of the development and application of new technology, higher unit development costs, and more complex operations to deliver a given production rate. These resources are much lower in quality as compared to Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, though they face the similar challenges associated with Arctic conditions and the distance to market. Therefore, we are concerned with the administration's original proposal, which is weighted towards a higher tax, which could prevent some of Alaska's challenged resource from being developed. The committee substitute contains even higher tax rates, which may prevent even more of the challenged resource from being developed. On February 28, I testified in Senate Resource Committee about our key concerns with the Senate Bill 305 as originally proposed. And then on March 18, I testified again before the Senate Resources Committee about how the proposed changes incorporated in the committee's substitute bill exacerbate those concerns. I don't intend to cover every aspect of the bill or all of my previous testimony, but I will provide comments in really three areas: the increase in the base tax rate and the addition of the progressive tax rate component, the committee substitute's transition provisions, and the elimination of the royalty settlement agreements as a determination of market value. Senate Bill 305, as originally proposed, would represent a significant increase in the tax increase on the industry. And as I just outlined, we're concerned that the higher tax rate could prevent some of Alaska's remaining challenged resource from being developed. The committee substitute bill increases the already high base tax rate to 25%, and then further increases it as oil prices increase. Higher tax rates discourage investment. Companies are willing to accept the risks of long-term capital-intensive investments when there's a corresponding opportunity for upside potential through a variety of factors, such as increased production or higher prices. When you limit or reduce the benefits companies can achieve from the upside factors, you reduce the attractiveness of those investment opportunities. The proposal to increase the already high base tax rate and then further increase it as oil prices increase reduces or limits the upside potential, which will result in companies recalibrating investment decisions. Reduced investment will result in reduced resource recovery, diminished state revenues, and fewer employment opportunities, with a resultant negative impact on the state's economy. Again, let me emphasize this point. While higher taxes may bring additional revenues in the short term, Any reduction in investment and subsequent production will significantly impact those revenues in the longer term. We think the focus of the tax bill should be on encouraging investment and growing production, which is not accomplished with the higher tax rate and the increasing tax rate with oil price. I'd now like to discuss the committee substitute's transition provision. The benefit from a typical oil and gas investment may take many years to be realised. Satellite and tertiary recovery investment decisions by our company during the last 5 years were made under the ELF structure, anticipating a lower tax relative to that proposed under PPT. The state appropriately provided this incentive to these challenged and costly projects so they could be commercially viable. Senate Bill 305, as originally proposed, recognised that it's not appropriate to suddenly increase the taxes on these prior investments without providing some form of consideration. The Senate Resources Committee included transition provisions in the committee substitute bill, but proposed a deduction based on recent investments, with the pace of those deductions linked to future spending. As I stated, the purpose of the transition provisions is to address the sudden increase in taxes on the recent historical investments, and future investment decisions will be made under the new tax system based on the balance between the new tax rate and the credit rate. For this reason, we think that the administration's proposal of providing a deduction based on recent investments not linked to future spending is more appropriate. Finally, I'd like to express our disappointment that the provision allowing the use of the producer's royalty settlement agreement to determine the value of oil and gas has been removed from the committee substitute bill. That provision addressed a long-standing issue that has divided the state and industry over the years. Too many years and too much money has been spent in disputes over how to value a single barrel of crude oil or a single molecule of gas. It made little sense in the past, and it makes little sense today for the state to have separate divisions determining the value of oil and gas, one for royalty and one for taxes. There is only one value in the marketplace. Senate Bill 305, as originally proposed, allowed the state to value a producer's oil and gas using the producer's royalty settlement agreement, which was negotiated with and approved by the Department of Natural Resources. That provision was important to industry as it provided certainty to the producer on the value on which to pay its royalty and production taxes, while reducing the administrative and audit costs to both the state and industry. We urge the committee to reinstate that provision. In summary, the quality of resources and the risks undertaken by a producer and the impact on the state's overall investment climate must be factored into the design of the tax system. While industry needs predictability and durability under which to gauge investment decisions, the attractiveness of that predictability and durability is lost if it comes at too high a cost. Despite our concerns with the original Senate Bill 305, we are prepared to move forward under that system as originally proposed, since it sought to provide a balance of the revenues to the state and producers across a range of oil prices, provided sufficient incentive for producers to undertake exploration and development risks, and included reasonable transition provisions for past investments. And most importantly for ExxonMobil, oil fiscal contract terms consistent with the administration's proposal would provide the predictability and durability necessary to advance the gas project to the next phase. Potential changes to the administration's PPT bill should be carefully considered to avoid upsetting the balance contained within the bill. Changes would require a re-examination to ensure the underlying health and stability of the oil business is sufficient for a gas pipeline project. As I mentioned, the proposed committee substitute exacerbates our key concerns regarding tax rates and certainty. And for these reasons, and the need to move ahead with a review of the gas pipeline fiscal contract, we urge the committee to support Senate Bill 305 as originally proposed. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm happy to address any questions.
Thank you, Richard. Are there any questions? Senator Dedman.
Madam Chair, we got two, numerous issues, but two of the bigger ones is impact, potential impact of the gas line contract negotiations. And the other one, which I think is more viable or critical to this bill, and that is the impact on drilling and development over the next 5 to 10 years to minimize our decline in production, which has been talked about by the previous presenter in some great detail. I have a hard time believing that either a 2520 or a 2020 tax change versus the status quo is going to make a whole lot of difference on the gas line negotiations. Just my independent opinion. And at $40 a barrel, the status quo under the current system, according to the Department of Revenue, the from there to the 2520, the profitability would definitely decline from the industry perspective because of a tax rate increase. But they're showing us that they're, you know, the corporate profits going from 3.8 billion down to 3.6 billion. And at $60 barrels, it goes from 6.9 billion down to 6.1 billion. Just the magnitude of change under the current proposed system, and it's relative to the one at the table, the profit to the industry would have went from $40 a barrel at 3.8 up to almost 7 billion at $60. So I think when we take a look at the impact of a dollar change in this commodity, has a huge impact versus the tax consequences of what we're looking at doing, adjusting for the fair share that Alaska should have as the owners of the resource. I think the concern, Madam Chair, is at the $20 range, when we move into the low end of the price scale, that we make sure we don't have a structure that puts the industry at such a disadvantaged position that they are no longer inclined to, you know, to operate and expand. And I recognize in the paper there's been all kinds of ads and information on the potential impact of the gas line. At $40, $60, $50, $65 a barrel, it's not going to change the gas line contract, in my opinion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But I think that the numbers that Senator Stedman are referring to do not include progressivity, and those figures would change quite a bit if progressivity were added to those figures.
If I could, the progressivity, Madam Chair, in the Senate version would trigger $40. So it wouldn't trigger on the earlier numbers. On the $60 price range, it is true, progressivity would be triggered, and it would push that profit margin down somewhat, but we'll look in that in more detail with Econ 1. But I guess the point is that at $60 barrel, $50 barrel, we're at such an abnormally high, historically, range in oil prices, it's not going to affect those decisions. The area where it could have an impact is on the lower range of the oil prices when revenue is marginalized due to the impact of the decline in the price of the commodity.
Richard?
Madam Chair, if I could just make a couple of comments about Senator Stedman's comments. I think that one of the things that we're very concerned about is the health of the oil business in the long term. And it's not just a question about its near-term viability or profitability, it's about the long term and about the development of the challenged resources, all of which are a lot more difficult to get than the current oil production out of Prudhoe Bay and Kupari. So our view is, and our comments are really related to the long term and long term stability and the health of the oil business that we need to ensure that so that it does underpin a gas project.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. On the issue of long-term, again, all that underlies our conversations here are the price of oil and I think all of us are happy that it's 60, but in Exxon's view, what is the long-term view of the predicted price of oil?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Bundy. You know, we and I'm sure that you've probably heard from others, we don't share an outlook really for price. You know, it's we run prices around ranges of prices. Our chairman has made comments this year, and our former chairman made comments last year that prices, we don't believe that prices, that the market conditions support the price where it is today, and we think that it had come down. I guess that's all I'd have to say on the matter. I mean, we don't have a price forecast that we would share.
Thank you.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. It seemed that you said or implied that there's no way we could improve the governor's bill. Did you mean to imply that?
Well, through the chair, Senator Dyson, there probably are ways to improve. There's not every aspect of the bill. And we've made some comments on how to improve some of the mechanics of the bill through the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. But we would say that we have had a lot of time to study the governor's bill. We understand how it was put together. We understand the balance that it creates between producers, explorers, large players, small players. And there are probably other things that could be done to it. But the bill as originally proposed is a bill that we can and would provide the predictability and stability that we're looking for. So I'm not saying it couldn't be improved, but I'm saying that the key features are important to us.
Yeah, I understood that. Would it be also fair to say that you consider it better than the two other alternatives that are kind of being discussed today?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, you mean the committee substitute bills?
Yeah, ours and the one in the House.
Yes, I think we would prefer the bill as originally proposed.
And when did the recommendations from the Oil and Gas Association, how was that presented to us?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, they were made through to both the committees. I think that the Alaska Oil and Gas Association testified. Most of the issues that they raised were about the mechanics and the administration within the bill.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dyson, I think those were handled in Senate Resources.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go to page 5 of your presentation? Page 5, second paragraph, well, there's only two, I guess, top one and the bottom one, hits on a very a point that the Resources Committee had spent quite a bit of time on, and that is the royalty settlement agreements. And in the bill here, for those that happen to have the bill, on page 14 in the center, addresses that. And could you please reiterate your testimony and tell us why you're uncomfortable with this language? And because this is a point that's in discussion, and it's been modified, and as both of us know, as we've watched this process and worked with this, and it's a matter that is easily, I guess, overlooked by many people.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I mean, our testimony and what I was trying to explain, I'll just paraphrase, is that the royalty settlement agreements provides a very clear and well-defined process for us to value production. And it's a process that works. It has, it's been agreed with the Department of Natural Resources and provides us the ability to both calculate it as well as dispute resolution. It has a reopeners process in it in terms of destination value and how things are valued as well as what costs are deductible. And so it's a process that we understand very clearly and we feel comfortable with using.
Madam Chair, if I could have a follow-up. So I take it from your testimony that by excluding this, it would make it more cumbersome for the industry to operate and more prone for disputes and litigation and
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that's right. I mean, really, what it does by removing it is means it has to be either completely recreated in some other way, and it just creates uncertainty. It'll be subject to, I guess, regulation as to how it would be done in the future. But right now, we would like to have the ability to value according to our royalty settlement agreements, which we understand and we've been using.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's one of the points that we may want to look at. It's just one of these discussion points, so we're comfortable with whatever comes out of the committee here.
Sure. Are there other questions? Well, I would ask you the same question. If we develop a list of questions, of points raised in committee, would you consider looking over those and providing answers?
Yeah, absolutely, your view? Madam Chair. Okay. We'd be pleased to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Richard Owen? Senator Stedman?
I'd just like to, I know we asked the previous presenter the same thing, and maybe I'll point it out again and they can get back to us, but at some point here in the near future, we're going to have a discussion, I think, of the impact of changing that credit rate at 20, 25 to 30. It may not even survive long enough to get on the table for discussion here, but clearly Econ One is working on that. Senator Dyson and myself are both interested in looking at those potential impacts with the issue at hand as far as stemming the decline of production, and I am interested in Exxon's position on that. And I recognize your position would be naturally to move the tax rate down. It's more beneficial, I understand that, but the isolated question is, if we modify the credit, will it, in your opinion, help stem the flow or the fall of production, and at what magnitude?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stedman. Certainly credits help, because credits are basically, they're reducing the barrier to investment. They offset some of the upfront costs for investment. I guess the bottom line answer to your question is, yeah, they help. But what has to, and I'll just temper that by saying that what's also important is the total project and the revenue stream. And what the credit, the high credit rate, will reduce the barrier to investment, because it just helps to offset some of those costs. But if the tax rate, if the overall tax rate is too high, then you actually take so much of that revenue stream, you impact the attractiveness of those projects. So it's very important to have them balanced. But having said that, credit rates reduce the barriers to investment.
If I could have a follow-up, Madam Chair. I think, well, when we look back at some of the previous testimony and presenters, and we've had this discussion that, and we've looked at the Econ Ones did the modeling on the pools of oil, the smaller pools, the declining potential declining state of the North Slope, which we're trying to turn to expansion state with this gas line and a few other things. But we've been told that no matter what we do, tax rate wise, credit rate wise, we're never going to be able to compete in Exxon's world against our competitors worldwide that have vastly larger pools of resources to drill on, and we are just at a competitive disadvantage due to the size of our oil field. Is that true, or do we have a hope of bringing Exxon up here to drill holes in the ground?
Senator Stedman, through the chair. ExxonMobil has been very active in Alaska, and we've explored extensively. We currently invest quite extensively in the North Slope. We support the operations through at Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, and all of the areas we have interest in. I'd also say that we're pursuing all of the economic opportunities that we have available to us. We're keen to continue to invest in Alaska, and we're currently trying to make projects that are marginal or technically or economically challenged, we're trying to make those projects go. So I wouldn't say that Alaska isn't competing. Alaska, we just look at Alaska as a place where we do want to invest. But we want to maintain our investments up here. The question is, will the tax structure enable all of those opportunities to go? And our testimony that we've made here and in the Senate resources is that some of those opportunities are challenged, and higher taxes are going to make them commercially unattractive. So that's why it's important to get the tax structure right, tax and the credit structure right, so that it's balanced to enable all of the opportunities out there to be developed. But if we see a commercial opportunity in Alaska, we're going to invest in it.
Thank you. Senator Wilkin, do you have any announcements?
No. Thank you.
We will meet tomorrow at 9 a.m. And be reminded that we will go from be at ease tomorrow after session, and we'll go join the House at 1:30 for their hearing on PPT, and then we'll come back at 4:30 for the operating budget. So we'll be in finance a lot tomorrow. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I handed out to you all an article I pulled out of the Economist about fiscal regimes in the North Sea, and I just commend it to you.
Very good. Anything else to come before this committee? Thank you, Richard, for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.